Thank you. Natürlich.
Of things right now, but he'll log in by 6:30, if not sooner. So, Mary Jean, is it okay to begin? Mary Jean, can you hear me?
You're on mute on both your devices.
And I'd like to welcome everybody to the December 14th meeting of the Health Commission. As a point of procedure, I would like to ask any commissioners looking to speak on the topic to, it looks like we have everybody on video, so please raise your hand and wait for the chairperson, Mary Jean Sage, to recognize you before you start speaking. And remember to take your Zoom connection off of mute to speak. And when you're done speaking, please place it back on mute. For anyone looking to leave public comment, you can leave public comment during the meeting by emailing myself, mcoughlin@co.slo.ca.us. And we will make every effort to read public comment during the meeting, but we will also keep a written record on our website of all public comment. With that, I will cede the meeting over to Chairperson Mary Jean Sage.
Thank you, Mike. We will go ahead and call the meeting to order. We will just add one comment. Mike, can you monitor the hands that are raised? I can't see everybody, so just let me know if commissioners want to speak so that we can certainly recognize them.
We'll do.
So this is a time when we allot for public comment. If there are persons desiring to speak on an item that pertains to what we do but it's not on our agenda this evening, we would ask them to be heard at this time since we're meeting virtually. Were there any public comments that were emailed in, Mike?
No, ma'am.
Okay. So again, as Mike said, you can make public comment during the meeting if you will email the proper address. We do have one consent item tonight, which is the approval of our meeting schedule for the upcoming 2021 calendar year. It was part of our meeting packet. Hopefully you all had a chance to run through it. Does anybody have any comments or any changes that they think need to be made? We will, in the month of October, not be meeting on our regularly scheduled second Monday of the month because we do have a holiday that falls on Monday that month, so we'll be meeting the third Monday instead of the second. Otherwise, and we will be dark next month, January, with no meeting. Any other comments before we call for a vote? Okay, seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to accept the consent item.
So moved.
Thanks, Jean. And seconded by Lynn. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Okay, Carrie. So this evening, we have with us Laurel Weir, who will talk about our COVID and planning for our homeless community. You'll recall perhaps last month we had a question or two about that, and we thought Laurel would be the person to have with us this evening. So I will turn the meeting over to her, and thank you for being with us, Laurel.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. All right. I am going to go ahead and share my screen for a moment. Okay. Let's see if I can do this. So thank you for inviting me. I am going to be talking about COVID-19 and homelessness here, and I chose this photo because it seems to represent this year where we had a nice linear plan for it, and it all went awry. I'm going to be talking tonight about giving you a little bit of information about the prevalence of homelessness here. What we've seen in terms of the impact, and my apologies to Dr. Rosen if he joins us during the middle of this because he's lived through most of this with me. And lastly, talking about considerations for the Health Commission's ways in which you all might be involved with the response to COVID and the way it impacts on our homeless population. So first of all, just some quick statistics. The county does a count every 2 years of both sheltered and unsheltered persons. It occurs over a single period of a day, or actually really it's about 12 hours. And we go out throughout all the different parts of the county. We have teams that include people with lived experience who are our guides, who take us around to places where they know people stay. And our most recent count found 1,483 people. The vast majority of our folks are unsheltered in this county. It's a pretty large number compared to many other counties. And in fact, for a county of our size, in the 2019 count, were in the top 10 in the country in terms of the highest percentages of unsheltered persons. And in addition, about a quarter of the folks live in, those who are unsheltered live in cars, vans, or RVs. Last year, 68% were male. It hasn't skewed that heavily in the past, but for some reason in that particular year, it was trending more majority male. Our data from shelters and homeless services agencies was also consistent with a little heavier skewing towards males. And then 41% or approximately 40% had one or more disabling conditions. These are self-reported conditions, so it's not necessarily been verified by a medical provider, but we do surveys of folks, and so it's a fairly large percentage who have that. And that becomes relevant when looking at the housing barriers that folks have. One of the subpopulations that we track are the group who are called chronically homeless folks. And the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has a definition of this, which is that you have to have a disability, thus the 41% come into play, and you have to have met some durational requirements. Either you have to have been homeless continuously for a year or more, or been homeless on and off over the past 3 years, but have been homeless at least four times for a cumulative time of 1 year or longer. And so in the 2019 count, that there were about 20% of the folks who fit that definition. Obviously, with COVID happening and it becoming more difficult for folks to get out of homelessness this year, we do have some concerns that this number is going to go up some. And this is important because national data shows that people who are chronically homeless, even though they're not a majority of the population, they tend to use a majority of not only your homeless services system resources, but also your public health and safety resources. And this is a group that we have previously targeted with the 50 Now program, where we provided permanent supportive housing to folks who were chronically homeless. And we did see a decrease in the use of public health and safety resources among the folks whom we tracked. So this is a very important population in terms of impact on the system. This year, we have seen some new challenges that arose as a result of COVID. The shelters have had to redo what they're doing and redo their whole shelter configurations because of trying to create more distance for folks. And so that has resulted in reducing the shelter capacity. In the case of Echo Shelter in the North County, they took away one of the rooms that they use for families and were using that to help spread folks out more. They also experienced, they in Capslow and Five Cities Homeless Coalition, all of them experienced dramatically reduced numbers of volunteers. Many of the volunteers for all of those agencies are folks who are retired and unfortunately are also in the higher risk for complications from COVID group. So what we saw particularly in March was a pretty dramatic decline in their volunteer resources, and we still see that. So they have their staff have had to work a lot harder as a result of that. On top of that, COVID has created some uncertainty for the shelters and the homeless services agencies. What we see sometimes is that staff become exposed to someone, not usually at the shelter. It usually tends to be in their outside lives, usually a family member. And as a result of that, then they are quarantined for 14 days. If more than one staff person is quarantined at the same time, this can create some strain on the shelters. Also, meal programs have had to adapt by changing their programs from sit-down dinners, where you have a chance for people to socialize, to doing bag lunches, to go types of activities. And really having actually to discourage people from socializing. Echo noted that with some of their clients up in the North County, they've had to really talk to them about COVID and to get folks to take it seriously and not to do as much socializing after dinner as they would normally be used to. Public facilities, sorry, spelling error there. We've also seen especially early on in the pandemic, we saw a reduction in access to that as buildings were closed, parks in a lot of areas were shut down, and bathrooms were shut down. And so that created issues regarding public bathrooms. Libraries were closed. That reduces people's access to internet, which also reduces people's access to apply for benefits or to respond to questions via email from case managers, et cetera. So it created a lot of disruptions in that system. We are also finding that homeless folks have more challenges in terms of trying to get tested. They're not necessarily located in the same areas where the testing sites are located. And the community testing sites generally require scheduling in advance. So phone or internet access, again, if you don't have that, that makes it harder. And if the libraries aren't always available, that has reduced internet access as well. Public health department has been testing some of our folks who are in congregate facilities. There is only one public health testing site. And so transportation, trying to get folks up there can be challenging if the clients don't have a car. And then also trying to reconnect to clients to report on their test results. This is more an issue for folks who are unsheltered. At least if they're sheltered, the shelters can help us get into contact with them. But it does create problems for people who are unsheltered who don't have phone or reliable phone or internet access. They may have phones, but sometimes they're not. They run out of power, or they can't get a signal, or they aren't answering for a bit. And then in preventing COVID-19, it's created a need for mask distribution. Most of our homeless agencies have really stepped up and helped to distribute masks both to shelter clients as well as people who are unsheltered, distributing masks at meal programs, and taking them out on their outreach efforts. So we have really tried to get some PPE out to the folks who are unsheltered. In addition, as I mentioned before, some of the providers have really had, actually I hear this across all the providers, that they've had to really educate their clients about what COVID-19 is. Because the clients don't really have a lot of access to information about it. So trying to provide clear information to them has been an important challenge. And then also, as we look to the future, getting clients and staff vaccinated is going to be a new effort that we have not really undertaken on this level before. And that's something that I'd like to talk a little bit further about. I'll address that in the slide after this. But in terms of our community responses to the pandemic, we have focused through the Emergency Operations Center on creating more isolation capacity for each of our shelters, which includes placing trailers outside of the shelters. We have two at Echo and two at 40 Prado, where if they have a client who becomes symptomatic, they can place the client into the trailer to get them out of the regular population and then contact public health and arrange for them to be tested. Again, we've been focusing also on improving access to the testing, so hoping to find ways to get people tested. In some cases, public health has gone out to the shelters to do the testing on site. In some cases, people have gone to public health. One of the benefits of getting them tested at the public health department is that they do have that fast turnaround time for getting results, which is especially important if you're dealing with a congregate facility, so that we can know whether or not we have something to be concerned about at the shelters. We've also received a number of grants from the federal government under the CARES Act, we've been awarded the grants. They have been a little bit slow in coming in terms of the contracts from the federal government, but we have at least been awarded those. And our nonprofits are who've been selected to receive those grants are already going ahead and using those the promise of those grants to increase their outreach and services. In addition, the state has provided some funding under a program called Project Home Key, and that provided money to purchase a motel up in Paso Robles that you might have heard about. The Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo was the applicant. They were the only eligible applicant other than the county. So I know there have been a few questions about why did the San Luis Obispo Housing Authority apply for it, but they partnered with ECHO and were the lead applicants. They're also partnering with People's Self-Help Housing. They are going to use that 120-room motel to provide both non-congregate shelter that will be operated by ECHO. ECHO will have 50 rooms. So they will be providing year-round non-congregate shelter in Paso Robles, which is really important during the pandemic to be able to have a non-congregate shelter option. In addition, it'll add 63 new units of permanent supportive housing in Paso Robles. And Haslow is working on, they have to make some modifications to the units. They have to have kitchenettes in order to bring them up to high standards for permanent housing. But they are moving really quickly on that, and their goal is to have the property fully occupied by mid-February. So everything is moving forward very quickly on that, and with much thanks to the state for the funding that they provided for that. So I wanted to address how the commission might be able to help. What are some of the things that we are working through? Help with planning and preparing for vaccination, I think, is one of the most timely issues at the moment. Help identifying client and staff concerns and help with messaging and outreach. And I'll talk about that more in the next slide. Helping to identify barriers that might prevent willing homeless persons from accessing the vaccine and making recommendations as to how to address those barriers. That's something I'm going to be working with our homeless services agencies on, but we would greatly appreciate any input or assistance that you all can provide. Also, sharing your concerns and recommendations regarding how we might be able to improve access for homeless persons with other entities with whom you as individual members as well as the commission interact. Obviously, all of you have roles outside of the commission and are important in the community. And so to the extent that you all have an opportunity to educate folks about barriers that homeless people might face, we would appreciate your help with that, and particularly you as a commission. Because you do have play such an important role in our community in advising on health issues. And then lastly, I would encourage folks to consider listening to and sharing information from a webinar that the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council is going to be having later on this week. I've included the link in this slide, and I'll send the PowerPoint to you, Mike, for distribution to you all. But the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council has sought input from their consumer advisory board on the concerns that homeless people might have about the vaccine and why they might consider not getting it. They've also been developing a list of steps for communities to take to help ensure that the people experiencing homelessness do have access to the vaccine. And they did a shorter presentation on this last week at a webinar that the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development had. And so these points here on the slide are taken from that, but they are going to be going into more detail about how to prepare on this call on Friday. So if this is something of interest to you, I would encourage if you have a chance to join that. But I wanted to share a couple of these concerns that their consumer advisory board identified, because I think these will be important in our community as well. First one was that many folks who are experiencing or who have experienced homelessness, particularly those who've been chronically homeless, have multiple health conditions, and they want to know how will the vaccine work for someone with their particular conditions, not just generally how does it work for the general population. They also had concerns about safety and where corners cut. Will that impact the safety of the vaccine? The third was that some folks were on medications and they want to know, will this cause complications or side effects with the vaccine? And should I go off my medications before I take the vaccine or after? And then a fourth, they had concerns about the logistics for the second dose, and they want to know about, do we know for sure when and where the second dose is coming? What if there's a delay and the doses are farther apart than they should be? Do I have to get another shot? Does it still work? What if I can't show up to the second appointment on that particular day? Or if it's not somewhere that's going to be accessible to me. So there were a number of concerns about the second dose. And so the Healthcare for the Homeless Council recommended that we do have all of our homeless services agencies talk with our clients about any concerns that they might have so that we can begin to think about messaging and possible answers to that. And certainly, I don't know if you all are looking at all at client concerns or concerns of the public about it or anything around messaging, but to the extent that you are, I'm sure that many of the concerns of the general public are probably also applicable to our population as well. So I think this will be a really joint effort between all of our different groups and the county and the general public and all of everybody really to try to educate folks about why not only the vaccine is important, but what it will and won't do so that we can make sure that we address any of the myths out there and that we address some of the very real concerns that folks do have. So that concludes my presentation. I wanted to see if folks had any questions.
So thank you, Laurel. You certainly have had a lot of challenges to encounter and take care of, but you've been doing a great job. So we appreciate you taking time to be with us this evening. I'm sure some of our commissioners do have questions. So if you have a question, if you'll just unmute yourself, and Mike will kind of keep track of people who have their hands up so that we're not all talking at once. So questions from anybody? Lynn, do you have a question?
I just wanted to be able to note down about the webinar on Friday, more information about getting connected to that.
Yes, it's the National Health Care for the Homeless Council. It's Friday at 10, and I've included a link to that in the slide, and it's free. You just need to go to the link and register. And so I'll pass that slide on to, well, the PowerPoint on to Michael, and so he can share it with you all.
That was really what I was looking for, because I didn't write down all the information.
Yeah.
Tom O'Malley.
Okay.
Take yourself off of mute, please.
Sorry. Two relatively quick questions. One thing, I'm involved with a lot of volunteer organizations that are really unclear about volunteering for organizations like ECHO, homeless shelters, on with the stay-at-home orders. And that's probably a health department question, but how do you find out, other than, I suppose we can check in, you know, I just talked with the director at ECHO today, and it's not clear to me anyway, are volunteers considered essential workers and able to do work at shelters, or where do you find out information on how to help in those situations?
So two things. One, when this issue came up in the springtime, in talking with the EOC, what I was told at that time was that the volunteers who are working in support of essential activities are allowed to go to that volunteer location. I will say that right now, to the extent that that COVID is spreading, and some of the organizations are working in congregate facilities, we just also want to make sure that the volunteers are extra careful, because they are probably the most likely source of spread to clients. So really, really adhering to all of the safety guidelines around that to make sure that we keep people safe.
So we should probably call the county health department's line and clarify any issue questions, then would be the best source of information.
Or the county, the county public information line that's posted on the website. And if you make that inquiry, they'll get back to you.
Sounds good. Second question I have, I'm with a group working on funding for some pretty elaborate air filtration devices for the two North County shelters, or at least certainly at ECHO now. And is there a good source of information? One, it's very hard to get equipment and filters these days. And two, I know at California state level, there's a lot of changes on specifications, let alone from CDC. Are you aware of anything definitive for shelters specifically?
Not for COVID per se. There was a lot of research put out on tuberculosis and air systems, and a lot of specifications there. It might be helpful to look at. It was a group in Northern California, might have been UC San Francisco. I think they have a tuberculosis center. But they have a very good guide that gets into a lot of detail. And it might be good to look at, but I think the, tuberculosis, my understanding is the particles are larger than COVID. And so, one of your best sources actually is going to be Dr. Rosen for keeping up with the most current information. But certainly, like like you have, we certainly experience watching all of the guidelines change.
Yes.
But I would defer to Dr. Rosen on that.
Thank you.
Candace?
Hi, thanks, Laura. That was a great presentation. So my question is about, you know, I work with the syringe exchange program with Lois Petty. And so we've been going out to the encampments in Morro Bay once a week with Capslo, and then we're going about twice a month down in the Five Cities area. And we were going to Los Osos when that was there as well. And so some of the things that we've seen, just with respect to barriers, which I'm sure you've thought about all of this, but, you know, transportation is a really big one. Mm-hmm. Just getting people to get tested for if that's the goal, or vaccinated if that's the other goal. What can you use the CARES Act money for?
So you could use it, and that's a great question, because I do want to mention we do have a request for proposals out right now. It closes on Friday, but emergency solutions grants, COVID funding, and you can use it for transportation to testing to and from. That is an eligible use. So, you know, if any groups are interested in applying for funding for that, I would strongly encourage you to do so.
The other question about barriers is particular to the population that we work with at the syringe exchange. So, like for the Paso housing, for example, is that considered low barrier in terms of are folks allowed to use illicit drugs if they're there, first of all? And then I guess the other thing is we've got a couple of people who have had past felony convictions. Are they allowed to be housed there?
So, it is low barrier. I don't think illicit drugs will be allowed on site. So I think it'll be like damp housing as opposed to wet. It'll be behavior based. So, you know, as long as people are not being disruptive or causing problems, threatening people, that kind of thing. It will be low barrier.
And the felony, do you know about that or no?
I think that will be allowed, but the only thing is they will have families there, so they will probably be doing a check for registered sex offenders.
Yeah, this is a drug related felony.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't think that will be a problem because it is supposed to be low barrier.
Okay.
If you hear about any problems, let me know.
Okay, yeah, no, I just want to get the information out to our folks. And I guess the other thing I was going to ask is, do you have a good, not very many words, little handout or bullet points? Do you know what I mean? Like just that.
No, not yet, because it's fairly new. They've only been doing it for a week. So, but what I can tell you is if people are interested, they should go to the dinner program at Paso that Echo operates over at the fairgrounds. Or across the street from the fairgrounds. And they're not at full capacity yet. And right now they are prioritizing people who are in the high-risk categories for COVID or the shelter. So, and then with the permanent housing, I know that they're going to take at least some of the folks off of our coordinated entry list. And so they'll need to be talking to Echo about that. And again, I think we're going to try to do some prioritization for people at high risk of COVID complications.
Great. And this is probably not as much for you, but if Rick were here, and I'll probably email him at some point, but just a consideration, we do have a lot of folks coming from all around to the syringe exchange on Wednesdays at the public health department. And so that might be actually a good site for testing. They're already doing testing there. Obviously, we're after hours, but also if you were going to do vaccinations. So we've had public health nurses on site doing hepatitis B vaccines. We've had them doing flu vaccine clinics. And so, you know, even if it was just once or twice a month, to capture some of those folks that are coming anyway. It's just an idea.
Thanks, Candace. Good questions. Any other questions from commissioners?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Amy.
My question is about the role that Tima and the CAT team have played with COVID so far, and what the expectation for supporting vaccine distribution and mass distribution will be utilizing that team.
So it's interesting that you say that, because I had a conversation with some TEMA folks today just to begin talking about that. So, you know, I think right now it's not yet known, but I think certainly the fact that they are they have the mobile van and they can go out to certain parts of the county that don't have fixed services, that we would want to use them to help do outreach about the vaccine. And, you know, and I don't know if it's possible, you know, to have them actually deliver it. They do have nurses on staff. And so, you know, that could be something, because they could administer it. And the question is, what vaccine and cold storage and all the things that go along with that. And but yeah, I think they would be a great source of helping to expand that delivery if that works out. And there are all kinds of, you know, I haven't had a chance to talk with public health yet about it. And at some point when they're ready to look at that stage, then we'll be talking about all the different ideas. But yes, my hope is that Tima will be
involved. Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, if not, thank you again, Laurel. We'll appreciate to get the link for the webinar on Friday, because I think a few of us would like to participate in that. And good luck with the big job you have ahead of you. If we can be of any help in some specific reason, don't be afraid to reach out to Mike so that he can connect with us and we can get something organized for you. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks again for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
So we'll move on with our agenda. Item number 5 is an informational item. It's to receive any updates from topics from our previous meetings. Does anybody have anything to share from any of our previous meetings? Okay. We've had a number of different topics. I actually, come to think of it, today did participate in something that we had as a more than a year ago. You'll remember we had the students from the Paso High School, their health career pathway class came and spoke to us, and they were interested in not only attending our meetings, but working with us the best that they can. And so today they asked me, they did some mock job interviews. So I spent the afternoon and interviewed 9 of their students on the first phase of it. So there were some very interesting, very bright students that participate in that health class, a number of them wanting to be RNs, nurse practitioners, and there's one young lady who wants to pursue becoming a neurosurgeon as her career. So she has a long path ahead of us, but she seemed very bright and like she would be one that would succeed with that. So it was nice to be asked to participate in that from them having been at our meetings. So I see Dr. Rosen is on the line with us, so we'll turn to him for our health agency. Oh, I'm sorry, Susan, did you have something? If you'll unmute yourself. We can't hear you, Susan. Can you unmute? There you go.
Okay. I just wanted to mention that this week I caught a webinar that I'm going to send it out to Michael to get out to everyone, and it has to do, it's a hour-long report that has been done by our new state Surgeon General, and she just did an incredible job, and it has to do with the adverse childhood experiences, the ACE score, in its relation to chronic illness, and it covers all the areas from health to law enforcement, and they just looked at everything and the different things we can do. So it includes the report, but there's a it was about an hour that she did a presentation where she went through all of the research that she's been doing, and it was just excellent. So I'll send that to Michael so he can get it out to everyone.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Now, Rick, we'll turn it over to you.
Hello. How goes it, everyone? So I'm not sure what to report other than that there's a lot of COVID.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So we're following 21 different outbreaks that we're actively involved in. And I think the count of cases this morning was at 282, something like that.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it's definitely a surge.
Is there a trend to that? Those 21 different outbreaks, where are they coming from?
So the outbreaks we are involved in include skilled nursing facilities, other long-term care facilities, a few different fire stations, and what other sorts of entities?
All basically congregate settings of some kind?
Correct. Congregate settings, yes. And, well, we have the vaccine coming, so that is arriving tomorrow. And we have our plans together for how to distribute that. What else is there to report? There's quite a bit. We're shifting obviously we're a bit overwhelmed by the increase in volume. It's the most we've seen at any point in the pandemic. So we are having to make some changes related to that. One of those is that we will be changing our release from isolation and quarantine process such that for the vast majority of county residents, they will be directed to a web page to attest that they have met the criteria for release from isolation, and when their employer requires release for quarantine, and that will serve as their documentation. That kicks in tomorrow. We had quite a bit of discussion around both the CDC and the state put out a new guidance for duration of quarantine that essentially had the effect of creating some confusion because 14 days remains the preferred and safest duration of quarantine, but there is an allowance to shorten quarantine to either 10 days without a test or 7 days with a test. As a county, we elected not to go with the 7 days with a test duration, as that would miss about 5% of COVID cases. And that's about all I can think of to report. I'm sure I'm missing things, but feel free to fire away with questions.
So what can you share with us about the vaccine distribution? How's that going to happen? Where is it going? How many people?
Yeah, so unfortunately I wasn't in on on the details of that because I was busy dealing with outbreaks. But I can more or less review the areas that are emphasized. So healthcare workers are in the first tier. It's really geared towards healthcare workers who are on the front lines with regular patient contact. Other groups that are in that first tier include emergency medical services personnel and obviously skilled nursing facilities. That is a little bit different in that they will be receiving their vaccines directly through the pharmacy partnership program. We will be distributing some vaccines to intermediate care facilities, which are many of the facilities associated with Tri-County's regional center. And when I say that, meaning the congregate living facilities through Tri-County's.
So for those care facilities, are we vaccinating both the residents and the staff, the healthcare workers there?
Well, that's the idea. The emphasis will be on the healthcare workers, but the idea is to get both groups.
Jean Raymond has a question.
Okay. Go ahead, Jean.
For the people in long-term care facilities, the criteria of being their immune system's not quite the same as, you know, most of the population. Is there a plan to give it to certain of the patients and not others based on their immune responses?
Or no, there's really only one clear contraindication of the vaccine, which is a known severe allergic reaction to any components of the vaccine. Otherwise, there are no absolute contraindications. It's a consideration to look at how recently someone may have been infected with COVID-19. But that's it. So immune compromised is not a contraindication to the vaccine.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for giving us your evening, Rick.
Sure.
You mentioned you're following outbreaks that are primarily in various congregate settings. What percent of the total number of identified cases are coming from those settings?
A very good question. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, percentage-wise. I can give you a sense. So, you know, we're seeing when the skilled nursing facilities are experiencing outbreaks, about two-thirds to 90% of the residents are currently testing positive for COVID. So it's really tearing through the skilled nursing facilities.
So, very roughly, just off the top of your head, what portion of the positive tests you are unable to connect to some congregate setting?
Okay, so I can give you a ballpark. So
sure.
I would guess that we have. We have about 150 positive tests that we could attribute to congregate settings every week.
So that's 150 out of these days, 700 or 800, perhaps?
Correct.
So most of the cases are in the general community?
Yes.
Okay.
But when it gets into a congregate setting, it really
sure.
spreads pretty impressively.
On the health department's dashboard are listed number of active cases.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering how an active case is defined, and in particular, what portion of that day's active cases might be infectious.
So an active case implies that individual has not cleared their isolation period yet. So that means all of those cases are infectious.
They are proved infectious.
Correct.
That's a lot.
Yes.
I think today you listed something like 1,200 active cases, perhaps.
That sounds about right.
And then I've seen conversion factors that people use to estimate the total number of cases in a community based on the number of proved cases.
Yes.
And are you folks using...
No.
I see a conversion factor of 6x. Do you think that's
reasonable? Yeah. So you have to base... So we are, I think, our per capita testing rate is... I believe the second or third highest in the state. So you have to factor that into the conversion factor. So whatever the standard conversion factor is, ours would be lower based on our rate of testing.
Well, that's reassuring. And then my last question is on promoting vaccination. And has there been any interest from our elected officials to promote that along with the health department? I think it would be just wonderful to see our four supervisors lined up socially distanced and each of them getting their shot and have Penny give them their shot. I think that would make a huge difference in this county right now. I know they've given the health department pretty much free rein.
Yes.
Otherwise, they've been silent, and we really need their leadership now.
So I do not know if conversations like that have happened. But I think that's a great idea. I know that Penny has been looking for our first poster person vaccine recipient. And that's still to be determined. And it's pretty close. It's basically 2 days away.
Well, I have some suggestions, but I think I better stop talking right now.
Yeah, but I like your idea.
So, Rick, do you know, at one point, Penny was seeking people to be on this task force to work on messaging out to the community and also distribution issues, because she asked me to be on that. But did anything ever happen with that?
Yes. So okay. We have had at least two meetings that I can think of with various stakeholders. The emphasis has been on those tier 1A priority groups. So it included essentially the hospitals and the skilled nursing facilities.
Okay.
And we will have more meetings as we get more vaccine. So as we're able to move beyond that first tier, which we won't have enough to, we won't have enough to vaccinate everyone in that first tier.
So how much are you expecting?
We're expecting 1,900 in the very first shipment.
Okay. And do you know when you're going to get the second shipment?
Possibly is, so the second shipment will be Moderna. That's, it's contingent upon their, the Moderna EUA.
Yeah.
When that, so best case scenario is we would receive that on Friday, but I actually think that's a bit, optimistic.
Well, FDA hasn't yet given their final okay on that, have they?
Correct.
Okay.
So only Pfizer has been blessed with an EUA at this point.
Well, would that be enough to do our, to finish off our first tier?
No. Oh, with the Moderna vaccine or just our first?
With the Moderna, would that be enough?
With Moderna, I think so, yes.
Okay.
Jean Raymond has a question.
Okay. Yes. Now, I work at a hospital, and they get their own supply, or is the 1,900 part of public health, and then they, and I know that the facilities are getting their own supply through a different venue.
Right. So hospitals are receiving their own shipments of vaccine, as are skilled nursing facilities.
So our first shipment of 1,900, who's that going to go out to then, Rick? What kind of first-line healthcare workers if they're not at a hospital or a skilled nursing facility?
So there are a number of non-skilled nursing facility long-term care facilities.
Okay.
So those... amongst those are the intermediate care facilities, which I mentioned, that are associated with Tri-County's emergency medical services personnel, frontline healthcare workers, not in the hospital. I'm trying to think of other categories. I'm too far away from the board to kind of read my cheat sheet. Okay. But those are the big groups. Oh, for example, the PUF will be receiving vaccines. Okay. You know, the psychiatric healthcare facility.
What about CMC and Atascadero? Are they getting their own supply directly?
CMC, they are working. So the state prisons are receiving vaccine through CDCR.
Okay.
I do not know the timeline for that. And it's a little tricky for them. They haven't worked out how to vaccinate. So vaccinating the inmates is straightforward, and they have the personnel to do that. From a labor relations standpoint, they still need to work out how they are going to get their staff vaccinated.
Okay.
So they'll have the vaccine for that, but it's a bit tricky in terms of who can actually put the needles in the arms.
We have a question from Candace and Susan Warren.
Okay. Thanks, Rick, for being here.
Sure thing. Hello. Yeah.
Busy time.
Yes.
So the jail, is the jail in the first round?
So the jail healthcare staff, I believe, is yes.
Okay, but not the inmates.
Not the inmates, and I do not believe the correctional staff is in the first six.
And I think you were on this email, but I'm going to talk to Tara tomorrow about putting together like an informational, because my background's in immunology, putting together an informational sort of white paper-ish thing.
Yes.
What would be helpful for you all? Like, I can put together all of the science of the phase 3 trials and all of that, you know, because I enjoy that. Ooh. But I'm not sure how, like, what do you hear?
Sure.
I want to know.
Right. So I think, so adverse events associated with the vaccine, the data about when antibodies are detectable, data about what data that is out there demonstrating how long circulating antibodies persist. Those are questions that come up frequently. Any data around prior COVID infection and receipt of the vaccine. How different either ethnic groups or age groups respond upon vaccination.
Right, and like pregnant women and all of those different.
Yeah, so that's a little trickier. I don't think pregnant women were included in any of the trials or anyone under the age of 16. Mm-hmm. So there won't be a lot of that, but you know, it's worth mentioning.
I think there's one coming that didn't exclude. I think there's one coming that didn't exclude pregnancy, but I'm not sure. Okay. Well, shoot me an email if you think of any other things.
Okay.
And go ahead.
And Tara, talking with Tara will also be helpful.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that she has some really good ideas about, you know, scientific communication around risk, you know, and the vaccine hesitancy group of folks and how to kind of get them more on board. I'm really interested in trying to figure out how to put something together that's science adjacent, but that is, you know, convincing to different populations.
Right.
Yeah. And then the other thing I had, and this is probably no shock to you, but I am still very concerned about Cal Poly's timing when they're coming back. So I just urge you all at the Public Health Department, and I'm sure you're looking at this, but like students are moving back right after the new year. And so, you know, just working with Cal Poly's administration to try to do whatever you can to limit however you can.
Right.
So I don't know what I don't know how the hierarchy works there, but I'm really concerned. Right. So so far, all Cal Poly has done is made finals week virtual, which is at the end of the quarter and doesn't really help with the post holiday
beginning. Right.
Give students 2 weeks, one viral incubation period, to travel and then come back. You know. So
right.
So just I don't know. To whatever extent you're able to pass that concern on.
Yep.
Thank you.
So I know the emphasis has been obviously many folks share your concerns. The emphasis to this point has been very aggressive and frequent and comprehensive testing. That is where the emphasis has been. Yeah.
Susan, let's go ahead and take your question. Susan, did you have a question?
Sue, you're still muted.
You're still muted. Okay, Bob, did you have a question? We'll move on to you and then come back to Susan.
Yeah, I'd just like to add my concern to Candace's about the coming quarter at Cal Poly. And Rick mentioned that I believe they are focusing on a very aggressive program of testing and so forth. So my question for Rick is, if there is an answer available now, how much more aggressive will it be compared to the last time around?
So their aim is to test everyone on campus on a weekly basis via saliva testing.
Right, and that's better than what they were doing before, which was every other week, roughly. But they don't have the saliva testing ready yet, as far as I know.
So they did get their CLIA approval this week. So it looks like, you know, the pieces are in place for that.
That's kind of interesting about the CLIA approval. That's one of the things that this pandemic has done is used to be it would take you months to get a CLIA approval. You can do it in 10 days now. Go ahead, Bob. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, I was just going to rant, so I think I'll turn off my mic.
You can rant. You can do a quick rant.
Well, I thought, you know, I think it would be interesting to go back and look at the public information presentation that Penny did, perhaps in August, where she had where you had a couple of officials from Cal Poly, maybe just a week or two before all the students arrived. And I remember thinking at the time, these guys look like deer in the headlights. They really seemed unprepared. And I suspect that if we really dove into the statistics on it, that I was correct, that they were poorly prepared. And I have to say, I don't know how I'd do any better bringing several thousand young people into a community when they haven't seen each other. It's a terribly difficult problem. But I personally don't have a lot of confidence that it can be confined, even with once weekly testing.
Right.
The way to do better is to not bring them back.
Yes.
That's what other schools are doing. So,
I'm turning off my mic.
So, Rick, and I know this is more of perhaps a political issue than anything else, but our current stay-at-home order.
Yes.
It does appear to me, and this may be anecdotal, but that a ton of the restaurants are not adhering or complying. And I know that several of our villages have said they won't do anything about compliance. They'll follow up, but they won't do anything about compliance. Is there any messaging at all that's going out about that?
Well, Penny hammers away at it every week. Sure. I'm not sure what else, you know. I think the message is out there.
Well, and I know from a law enforcement standpoint, we don't have a lot of support in our county for that. But, I mean, there are some counties like Placer and Yuba and some of them up there that have been visited by the authorities. And it does seem to bring about compliance to some degree, at least.
Right.
And I do understand that everybody, we're all COVID fatigued at this point. God knows.
Right.
We had this big surge after Thanksgiving. Christmas is coming up. I don't know that many people that are adhering to it. And so we're going to be faced with another big surge, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I ranted for you, Bob.
Okay. Well, that was a new rant.
All right. Any other questions while we have Rick here?
Just one.
Go ahead.
Rick, is there anything that we can do at all from our end to help support from the political aspect of things, whether that be contacting our supervisors or our DA's office or our sheriff's office or whomever to be able to try to help support public health's efforts and message in any way? Is there anything that, as you know, anything that you think would make a difference in terms of us as citizens and constituents that we might be able to help do from that angle?
Great question. So I think that, so one challenge is that people's opinions are pretty fixed at this point around things like restaurants, for example, and mask wearing. I do think that communication could be helpful around vaccine hesitancy. So sort of getting the word out via social media when folks do get vaccinated and it goes okay, you know, to pass that along. I think that would be helpful, or to be honest, just talk about how the experience was. I think those sorts of things can be very helpful to try to improve or bring up our vaccination numbers. I think that is another thing that I would like to bring up that I think would be helpful. So CDC is launching a smartphone application called VSafe, V like victory. It looks like you've heard about that. I do think it's important to encourage folks to use that app once they're vaccinated. It's just a way to report how you're doing post-vaccination. And that's how we'll learn.
I think we lost Rick.
I'll text him to let him know.
Okay. On that same front there, and Tamar, maybe you or Candace know more about this, but there is that app that's out there that tells people if they're near somebody who has tested positive. The kind of downside of that, I understand, is you have to upload your test results to that. Right? Laurel is shaking her head. She knows about that. Is that correct, Laurel? I mean, it only helps if everybody uploads their positive results to that. So I don't know if that's worth doing any messaging on that or not. It's obviously brand new.
Yeah, and as I understand it, there's some mistrust there as well. Just because it's Google-based and one other Silicon Valley company. So there's already this mistrust there of how that data will be used and who has access to it, and regardless of you know.
I've heard that too. The mistrust is pretty significant.
Yeah, there will need to be some messaging just around that. But yes, in addition to just sort of having people be proactive and uploading their results.
Dr. Rosen just emailed me. He had a technical glitch. His phone battery just died. So he has to sign off for now.
Okay. All right. Well, be sure you tell him thanks for being with us this evening. We appreciate him taking his time and that. So I guess enough about COVID for this evening. Let's go ahead and move on to our agenda items. Number 7, any health commissioners have any updates that they need to let us know about? Jean, did you have something? Go ahead.
Adult Services Policy Council met on Friday. And there were, you know, it was basically a holiday meeting, but everybody there told a little story about who they were, what kind of services they offered, and other interactions. What was really interesting at the very end, we realized that we need each other and that kind of support. But in addition to that, you find out things that you didn't realize. And one of them was like the access program, you know, transportation is always a huge issue. And Mark Schaefer was talking about that they can give, if they sign up, if someone signs up, they can get rides door to door for $3. So, you know, if we have anybody that we have in any relationship, we need to pass that word along that if you have issues, it's not just through Medicaid and all the rest or Medi-Cal. You can get that. CHC actually has transportation for all their business. But we do have Ride-On, and then we have the other services. But the Access Program, it's called. $3 rides from door to door. So we need to promote that. That was the big one that I've walked away with. So because we can always have these people that need services. And he was even talking about, you know, COVID and what they were going to do. So it might be behoove us to ask what he does specifically, you know, as far as transportation.
All right. Anybody else have any updates?
Robert Campbell, I believe, has an update.
Okay. Go ahead, Bob. Sure.
Very briefly, the Tobacco Control Coalition, sad note here, the industry petition to get Senate Bill 793 on the 2022 ballot appears to be successful. So if those signatures are verified, then the ban on flavored tobacco products will be held in abeyance for 2 more years.
Mm. Tobacco and their big money, right? Okay. Any other updates? All right. So our next agenda item is to review our appointments to our liaison committees, because we do have a couple of new commissioners and we're happy that they have stepped up and agreed to be part of some of our liaisons. So Mike sent out the list as part of our agenda package. So you'll notice that Tom has agreed to step up and be part of our Suicide Prevention Council. Lynn has stepped up to be our representative on SART. And we do realize that some of these committees haven't been meeting on a regular basis. Some of them have been meeting virtual meetings, of course. We do still have an opening for our oral health coalition, and the oral health has started again meeting. They met last Tuesday, I think it was, virtually. We don't have anyone attending that. Bob, I'm going to assume that you'll still do Tobacco Coalition for us, unless I hear otherwise. And Tamar has been doing the Intimate Partner Violence Coalition. Along with that, because one of the things that's kind of a spinoff of that committee or coalition, if you will, is the Anti-Human Trafficking Task Force. And Tom has stepped up and said that he would represent us on that. I did, and they have an upcoming meeting next week, I think it is. And I did send your information over to them, Tom, as well as I had forwarded you that meeting notice. Jean will continue to do both the Commission on Aging and the Adult Services Policy Council. Jean has also agreed to be our alternate to the Preventive Health Grant Advisory Committee. We got the first notice today that the notice of grants will go out sometime probably mid-January, and then they will be meeting to review the grants sometime after the 1st of March. That grant money will probably be very important in this. It was important last year. It's always important as far as that goes, but it will probably be more important than ever in the coming years. I'll continue to do the Disaster Healthcare Coalition. Tamar has agreed to do First Five. Heal Slow, which has been quiet for quite some time because so many of our public health employees are off dealing with COVID here. Should they meet again, I'll continue to do that. Amy has been going to Healthy Communities, and Amy, I didn't really ask you, but is it okay for you to continue to be part of that group? I don't see Amy. Did we lose her?
We lost Amy at 7:25.
Okay. All right. So I assume she will. I'll connect with her and make sure she's okay with that. Susan will continue to do the Homeless Services Oversight Council. She also serves on a couple of their subcommittees there. And then lastly, Lynn has agreed to do the Care Coordination Coalition once they start to meet again. They've been in hiatus because they're supported by Michelle Shoresman, who has been super busy with COVID. So any other changes that any of you see? Ginger, is there something you'd like to be part of? I know you're working full time and it's kind of hard for you to get away, but if you want to do any of those or even try them out, let us know and we'll connect you with them.
Okay. I'll let you know.
Okay. Good. All right, and if any of you want to step up and do the Oral Health Coalition, that would be great, too. I'll try to support it until we have somebody in a position that would want to do that.
Mary Jean?
Yes.
As long as I'm not teaching in person, which is the rest of this year, I can do the oral health one because okay. I'm also the pre-dental advisor at Cal Poly, so
that would be great.
It seems like it would be good.
Okay.
And I don't see the Opioid Safety Coalition on there, but I'm still doing those meetings too.
Okay. We will.
If you want to add it.
We will get that on there.
Still, the contact name there is Jen Rhodes.
Okay.
Mary Jean?
Yes, Tom.
I was just going to say I have been in contact with both of those committees, and I probably won't be able to start until January. The one meeting, it's actually scheduled for Thursday. I have a previous engagement, but I will start up on them both in January for sure.
Okay, that should be fine. Thank you for doing that. Okay. Anybody else have anything?
Tamara did have to sign off also.
Okay. So the last thing we need to do this evening is to take a look at our upcoming agenda topics.
Next item would be discuss standing committees.
Oh, the standing committees. I'm sorry. I swept right past those.
No worries.
Does anybody want to change the standing committee that they're on? Anybody want to be put on one of the standing committees?
Lynn would like to speak, then Tom O'Malley.
Okay, Lynn, go ahead. You need to unmute yourself.
Yeah, I'm unmuted. I would be happy to help Tamara and Candace with the community education. When I was on the commission before, I sort of was into that. So,
okay. We'll sure put you on there. Tom, what would you like to be on?
Well, it's a popular item, apparently. I was had some ideas on community education, too, reaching groups that haven't been reached, perhaps. And so we can talk about that.
Okay. We'll take input and participation from anybody, so I'll put both of you on there. Okay. All right, so I think we have our standing committees pretty well staffed. So now we'll go on to the item about upcoming agenda topics. The last time we had a planning meeting, we actually planned out quite a bit ahead of time. So we do have some items proposed for our agenda. For the next few months, we have a whole in June, one in August, and then one in November.
For June and August, we did have topics. We just, at the last meeting, did not name who would be handling those topics.
Oh, okay. So pedestrian safety. I think as we talked about that, as I recall, Amy brought that up because one of the things that they talk about in healthy communities all the time is pedestrian safety, not only for our Safe Routes to Schools programs, but some of the others. So if you're all okay with that topic, we can look at getting one of our commissioners to support that topic.
Yeah. And don't forget SLOCOG, because they're, you know, they have a lot of programs and they get the sure. money. So to make sure that they're at least contacted.
Okay. Is that okay? Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was just going to say I could help with that topic. I used to be chairperson on the San Luis Council of Governments and also worked a lot in the area of ADA accessibility and safe routes to schools and those kind of things. So if there's somebody working on that topic, I could work with them.
Okay. So how about I'll connect with Amy and maybe we can have you and Amy be responsible for that. Okay. Great. Candace, are you okay to still do the blue bag program in March? Oh my goodness.
I think
so. Do you think that's appropriate?
Yes.
Okay.
I might tweak it a little bit.
Okay. All right. Good. And then Ginger, you and Tamar, we're going to do the cancer care for April. Are you still okay with that? I mean, we're kind of in flux yet, and we'll have to see what's going on with COVID and everything. But keeping in mind that we can work on this, and if we have to tweak some things or change it at the last minute, we'll be flexible and do that.
Sounds good.
Okay. I mean, I think one of the issues for a lot of our cancer patients now is because of COVID and the social distancing and what have you, they're really clamoring to get the care that they need and to be able to do all of their stuff. Okay. So for August, we have food security. I know that was a suggestion from Amy as well. I could help with that because I get the stuff about our San Luis Food Coalition and the things that are going on with that. November care coordination. And to be okay, I see Lynn and I see Jean on that. So Lynn, go ahead first and then Jean. Yeah.
No, I'd be happy to work on that, and I'd be even happier to work on it with Jean.
Okay. So is this a done deal? Yes, what? Jean?
I think it'd be a great, I enjoy working with Lynn. That'd be wonderful.
Okay. by golly, I think we have all our spots filled in. Do we, Mike?
We still have no. Actually, yes, we do. We had November double filled, so.
Okay. All right. So, Lynn and Jean, it's November of 2021, not 2020, that you're going to do this, all right?
We do have one opening. I apologize. It's been a little crazy in the office. The opening we have is actually for September.
Oh, yeah, I don't see September on there. Okay. Well, why don't we do this? Since July is typically a planning meeting, and we have it down here as a planning meeting as well. We'll have to see whether we can do it in person or if we need to do it virtually. But let's be thinking what we might want to do in September. And I think if we picked something in July, we could still do it. I think that would give us time enough to do it. And in fact, that might be a time for us. In February, I see we're going to have the COVID response and some vaccine updates. It might be time for us to revisit that because that would be about, 6 months mm-hmm. after that. So it might be time to revisit the whole COVID issue at that meeting.
That will work. I'll pencil that in.
Okay. Okay, anybody have anything else to add? Bob, was there anything you wanted to see put on the items?
No, I couldn't add anything. I think we'll still be consumed with COVID mm-hmm. for at least another 6 months. So there'll be no problem filling up our meetings.
Okay.
May I, Mary Jean, before we dismiss the meeting, I did a little back of the envelope calculations based on what Rick told us about perhaps 1,200 identified infectious people in the county, multiplying that by the factor I've used of 6x suggests 7,200 people in the county are infectious today, which works out to about one out of every 40 people we meet on the street. So it behooves us all to really, really take care of ourselves and those that we work with and be doubly, doubly cautious.
Well, I think as commissioners, we're all into setting a good example and doing what we do. I know we made the decision not to visit family for the Christmas holiday this year, much to the chagrin of our 47-year-old daughter, who this will be the first time in 47 years that we've not seen each other for that holiday. But, you know, number one, we want to do our part and pay attention to the mandate or to the order that's out there. But more importantly than that, I think it's to keep them safe and to keep us safe as well. And I know that, you know, just look at the numbers. It's community exposure. That's where all of these are coming from. So if we can all do our part, that would be wonderful, as I know we all will that are on the commission. So with that, does anybody else have anything to add this evening?
I just want to do a shout out to our, you know, public health department. They're doing an outstanding job and going to be supportive of any way that we can. And mm-hmm. we should really be patting ourselves on the back and the fact that they have more testing than, you know, we're a small county and they're doing better testing than most of the whole state. So we really do, you know, Dr. Campbell, we do have a better idea of what's really happening versus we're just multiplying it times six. So just, an overview looking at things.
Okay.
Any way that we can get to the public health, and if they need any help, let us know. I mean, let me know too.
Sure. Well, I think we do keep reemphasizing to that. I actually wish they would come to us for a little more help and let us participate in the messaging or whatever that's out there. I'd like to take Bob's suggestions about the vaccine rollout and that to them and see if they would do anything with that. If any of the rest of you, as you come across things in your daily work and lives and what have you, have any suggestions what we can do. I mean, Susan, you work with a lot of different populations. If you know, you come across something that you think that we should be involved in or we should participate, send us a text or an email or something so that, you know, we can get on with that. And thank you, Candace, for agreeing and bringing it up, first of all, and then agreeing to do it, to work with Tara to get the messaging out about vaccine. I greatly appreciate you keeping us in mind with what you're doing at Cal Poly and being so proactive with some of those things. So does anybody else have any further comment this evening or anything they want to say?
I would just, Tom, Candace, give me a call because I'd like to talk about that community messaging and community education. Besides, I'll get you to speak at Kiwanis. So that'd be great.
That's great. I'll send you an email first.
Well, I think that's the way we come more visible, actually, Tom. So, I appreciate that. And Candace is a wonderful speaker. You will love any slides that she puts together for whatever she does with that. So, you know, if we can use each other the best ways we can during this, well, I appreciate that. So with that, I want to let you all go for this evening. I'll say happy holidays to everybody. Stay safe. And we won't see you in January, but we will see you just before Valentine's Day in February. Okay? Good night. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Take care. Stay safe.